So today I'm with Chris Dixon, who I find it kind of funny. He's called the new Fred Wilson. Fred Wilson is a top VC in New York City, and Chris has been writing some really good blog posts on investing and how startups work, which is where I've been following him. Chris is the co-founder of Hunch.com, and I just walked into his offices and met Katarina Fake, who's the co-founder of Flickr, and also Hunch. So it's pretty cool to be here. So Chris, thanks for taking the time to interview.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so just very briefly, my background. Originally, I grew up in Ohio, and I moved to New York to go to college, and I've been in New York for about 15 years now, and sort of one of the people that came to New York and immediately fell in love with it. Just the sort of vibrancy and all the sort of interesting things happening in the city. Just think, okay, I was a computer programmer, sort of to support myself for a number of years. I worked at a sort of high-tech hedge fund right after college. I worked for a couple of years at venture capital at a firm called Bessemer Venture Partners, which is kind of one of the kind of big old VC firms.
Pretty old offices.
Well, it's sort of a classic billion-dollar early-stage venture fund. They've been around for a long time. They have offices in New York. They used to have an office in Boston. I think they have a small office in Boston and one out in Palo Alto or Menlo Park. So I worked there for about 2 years, which gave me, I think, kind of an interesting perspective of having seen the VC world from the inside. I left there to start a company, which was the idea was it was around 2004 when, if you remember, this was actually pre-Firefox, sort of spyware and phishing were at their peak. Sort of when you were on the web, you were going to Internet Explorer and ActiveX pop-ups were popping up and spyware was everywhere and et cetera. And the idea was that start a company that tried to solve these problems by creating a reputation system for the web. So basically saying these are good websites and these are bad websites. The idea was that sort of the existing security companies like McAfee and Symantec were very focused on kind of solving what are known as sort of technical threats as opposed to social engineering threats. They're sort of focused on problems where sort of the browser is malfunctioning or being broken into, et cetera. And the idea was kind of that really a lot of regular internet users' problems were that they just didn't know whether they were dealing with a reputable website.
And you sold the business, right?
That's right. So we were acquired by McAfee.
How was the sale?
It was a very positive outcome. We raised money from VCs and they did very well. It was sort of approximately 10 times their money, so that's what they kind of looked for in investments.
And you didn't go into retirement recently?
No. So I had a 15-month lockup at McAfee, and I had to work there. And it was sort of strange because they didn't really want me to do much. I was the co-founder CEO. They wanted my technical team. They wanted those guys to do work, but for some reason they didn't really want me to do work. But they wanted me to hang around. So I did a little bit of work for them. I tried to do work for them. They also had three CEOs while I was there. They were part of the options scandals. So while I was there, one of the things I got interested in doing was kind of helping out my friends with their startups and also investing in their startups. So basically angel investing.
Do you angel invest while you're working?
Yes.
And Max, because it's in your downtime.
That's right. That's when I kind of got into it originally, and then I continued to do it. And so I've invested in about 15 companies since then. And
what kind of investments are?
I also would be part of, sort of seed rounds. I'll do some piece of a seed round, which will say the average deal size, the total deal, meaning the syndicate, will be between $300,000 and $800,000 type kind of thing.
So you put $50,000
in that range, yeah. That depends on the deal and things like this. But obviously we'll always be, partly out of, because, we have limited, I have limits on life and investment, also partly because it's good to have a lot of other people. We always indicate things. So we'd always get a big group of people, especially people that are, relevant to the industry at the startup end, right?
And we do that because then they effectively have a team of us helping them.
Yeah, that's right. And, I found that it's much better to have, if the person in the position to do so, to get someone, let's say you're starting a security company, to get an experienced security person to invest in angel rather than sort of bring them on as an advisor, because then they have kind of skin to the game, as they say. And so, we try to do that. Some people don't have, obviously, the financial resources to do that, in which case then you work something else, let's say a professor or something like this. But many times these successful business people will, and so you sort of try to bring in interesting groups of people. So kind of put a bunch of these together. Also sort of help people. I've been through this early stage on both sides of the table, kind of as an entrepreneur and as a VC. So we try to kind of help people both raise that initial round, but then also kind of get the company to the stage where they can then raise a proper VC round. Mm-hmm. Right? So kind of really focusing on that stage and helping in that way, not sort of trying to micromanage the product. Kind of
do you know a little bit of finance before you start doing it?
Well, I do finance in the abstract. I worked at hedge fund post college. Actually, I try to pretend like I didn't buy into business. I went to Harvard Business School, so I have an MBA. So I know something about finance. And then I worked in VC for 2 years, and then I raised money as a startup. So I've been, and then I've invested in that 15 times or so. And then actually, I'm actually going to talk about this for the first time on Blog Monday, but I've
since, and I'd ask you if you wouldn't mind just holding off.
Well, this
okay. And I was going to say it's going to be in a few weeks. I know that you wouldn't, but just so you know.
So
on Monday I was going to say that what's happened is that the people I've been co-investing with, we've decided to formalize kind of what we've been doing, mm-hmm. and we started an actual seed fund, which we've been investing, we started about 3 months ago, mm-hmm. and are going to start talking about it pretty soon.
So that'll be before this. That'll happen by the time people.
And so it's sort of, I think, it's part of this.
So in many ways, it's a breaking news site.
So it's sort of part of, it's really doing what we've already been doing, which is I think, true seed investing. So the fund is $40 million, which is, by VC standards, very small. Mm-hmm. And that means that we can do, like, our sole focus is at this very, very early stage, putting in sort of small, quote-unquote, small amounts of money, like a couple $100,000. And those are our actual business, as opposed to something I blog about a lot, which is big VCs who have $400 million funds, and they put $100,000 into a company. There's just almost no way that $100,000 is meaningful to them. So what they're really doing is they're getting their foot in the door to kind of do the next round. What we're doing is actually investing and caring about that first round, which I argue a lot in my blog, and I think it's true, is far better for the entrepreneur because our interests are aligned with their interests. So for example, we in particular want to give them higher valuation in the next round, whereas VC put the majority of money in the next round, therefore doesn't want to see that happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's all sorts of weird incentives that happen when you have a giant fund. So basically, if you read about this kind of stuff, like VC world, there's basically a couple of things that happen that have caused that caused the VC industry to kind of be in a pretty bad situation. Mm-hmm. The first thing that happened is that, you know, what's called the Yale model, which is basically Scott Davis Swenson, who's the fund manager at Yale, pioneered, it's like 20 years ago or something, pioneered the idea of putting a lot of the university endowments into highly liquid securities, namely venture capital, private equity, real estate, so-called alternative investments. The idea was because they're college endowment, they could take sort of 10-year horizon. They had sort of quote-unquote patient capital.
Right.
And they had outstanding results. So they had, you know, he's had like something 20-something percent returns year over year. Harvard did that. And then suddenly every other university copied it. Pension funds copied it. So everyone decided sort of, let's say in the 90s, 80s and 90s, they need to put 5, 10% of their money into venture capital, right? What that means is you have things like CalPERS, let's say, which is, I don't know, 800 California's retirement fund. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know, I think it's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. If they suddenly decided to put $5 percent into, you know, venture, that means something $50 billion is going to be the venture. You get this massive inflow, you know, combined also with .com bubble, where people make a lot of money in venture, you get this massive influx, right? Tons of new VC firms you can create. Meanwhile, you have this opposite trend, which is it costs less and less to kind of start an internet company, right? So you have this very capital-efficient internet company. So you have this real mismatch between these billion-dollar VC funds that are structured around a world where, like, you know, where you need to build sort of heavy hardware and
options. So you think the next generation is seed funds like?
I do. I think I'm the first, by the way. I think we're following in the footsteps of things people like Y Combinator.
Paul Grandler has
been. They've been pioneers, I think.
Techstars.
It's in Techstars, and I think it's also just maybe a little lesser known, but they're doing similar things. Mike Maples, Maples Investments in the West Coast. Ron Conway has this thing baseline, although he's sort of still separate from it now, which is a bit difficult. Micro VC, sometimes First Round Capital is sort of doing this, although they've got bigger fund now. BetaWorks in New York is doing some interesting stuff. So there's a bunch of people that have some new models, so they're sort of experimenting. And everyone's sort of doing a little differently, but I think these are also part of a trend, and we're sort of sort of following on that trend and with our own variation, which is that we have fun, but it's also everyone involved in the fund are entrepreneurs. And the entrepreneurs, even full-time, like me, I'm a full-time entrepreneur, I'm a full-time punch, but I'm part of the fund, and I help the fund make decisions. And part of the theory behind that is the practicing entrepreneurs are better positioned than many times to sort of understand and lead investments in areas they understand versus somebody whose, say, background is in banking or...
You know, when I lived in Silicon Valley in the 90s, and I worked at Oracle, and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Sorry, Larry. But one of the things I really felt was every time I came across VCs, is there were just these finance people who not really understand finance, so there's just these finance geeks that didn't understand business, but just were like really arrogant towards everything.
And they're very good with it. Yeah, it's a problem. I mean, I think something happens when you walk at $1 billion, and you found these fancy schools, and it's, you know, they, unfortunately, there's a lot of arrogance, and, you know, I think, and as someone who's raised money and also failed to raise money many times. I've spent on the other side of that.
Are you failed to raise money?
Well, no, I mean, when I started my first company, I had to go out and pitch 30 VCs before I managed to, you know, like, so, I mean, I did raise money, but 28 said no before, you know what I mean? Like, you know, yeah, I didn't reject it plenty of times, because, you know, it becomes easier.
Was that a side advisor or was that something else?
Yeah, before that, I tried some stuff. If I had an online marketing company before that, and, but yeah, side advisor. I mean, you know,
you're experienced full on your
own. I mean, Katarina, who's been very fake, who's my co-founder here at Flickr, they were laughed out of every VC in Silicon Valley, you know, for a long time until suddenly the site took off. You know, they're actually originally building a game, an old mass money put around the game.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we all have. And I think that makes us kind of, you know, understand the predicament of entrepreneurs and I think just sort of more respectful and also maybe more humble and that we don't know everything, and sometimes, you know, sort of serial listen. And
is this a fund that you run, or other people know I know?
No, there's two friends of mine who are serial entrepreneurs who, this is their new startup, and so they're doing it full-time. So I'm sort of involved as, I guess you could say, like, you know, on the side or something. And so for me, it's like, there are a lot of entrepreneurs who do angel investing, I think Silicon Valley, for example, and this is just sort of a way for, sort of a new vehicle to do angel investing, so.
And maybe you can help strengthen the startup community in New York City.
Well, that's part of the hope, yeah. I think that, you know, one of the things we need here is, I mean, we have some, you know, we have Fred Wilson, who's a great VC. Like I said, BetaWorks is doing really interesting stuff. There are other good VCs in New York. There's some angels here, but, you know, there's a few sort of tech angels. There's other sorts of, like, a lot of other sources of money here, like hedge funds, people who inherited money, things like this. And I don't think, you know, I think that's just, that's not...
I just want to ask you about that. Because you posted on your blog that you were at, well, you posted on Twitter, you were at an event where there was, you felt like there were people asking questions of startups, so just ask them. And I found that comment kind of funny. I think the challenge on Twitter, and I said, well, they, you know, maybe they're learning or something like that. But I think I read on your blog. What was going on? Because it was a very short exchange.
Yeah, so that was, there was a bunch of, like, tech star type people. Literally, I think it was tech stars and some Y Combinator companies that were based in New York giving an event. And this is one of the unfortunate things that happens in New York, and is that whenever you have these sort of angel events, there's sort of a few people that are like genuine tech people, investors, but there's also just like a bunch of people who, I don't know what, like they inherited a bunch of buildings on Fifth Avenue or something. New York is full of all these.
Full money.
Yeah, exactly. And they think it's sort of, oh, this is fun, you know, like let's go and invest in internet companies or something. And there's questions. I mean, like there are all sorts of reasons to be, you know, these are interesting companies, but like every startup, there are all sorts of reasons, you know, good questions to probe and challenges to give the entrepreneurs. In this particular case, it was, what was it? What they were doing? It was something like, I think it was like, they were doing lead gen for, I think maybe attorneys or something like this. And the question was like, wait, so you're gonna go and get some information about somebody interested in an attorney and then sell that information, which is a lead gen business, which is like a multi-billion-dollar business. And the person was like really just not aware that was a multi-billion-dollar business. So like, there's lots of reasons to say like in this particular case, like how are you going to build those? You know,
so they're outraged about the selling information.
Well, they just not even outraged. They just didn't even understand that that's big. That there's like huge business of selling. Like they just didn't. They're like happy. You know what I'm saying? And like that's just, there's all sorts of things to challenge that person on, including how are they going to get traffic? How are they going to, you know, go out and, let's say, you know, find these attorneys to buy.
But maybe that's the point where they learn how they start to invest.
Maybe. But I think there's.
You're out of work with the guys that know what they're doing.
I think it's good for New York to have more people who are actively investing who have direct experience in the industry. That's all. I mean, I'm sure those people who have direct experience in what they have experience in. It's not technology. Like that. I mean, it's just a different level. I go out to California, and it's just, you know, you don't have that kind of those questions out there much, you know. So you have some sophisticated people here, but it's like, you know.
Well, Silicon Valley didn't really understand much about lead gen until not long ago. I mean, and even still today, I think there's a lot of things.
That's like, for example, in lead gen, advertising, New York is actually generally pretty sophisticated. They just weren't the angel investors. Like, there's a lot of sort of, like, scrappy mom-and-pop kind of lead gen jobs here.
Right.
I don't know, so that particular thing. But also with hedge funds, I mean, that's died down a little bit with the financial crash or whatever, but for a long time here, what you see, especially, like, in financial technology, which is an area that I think is interesting, and, you know, like somebody, let's say, starting a new, you know, market for trading whatever, something, or some new trading software, okay? Like, in theory, that would be an interesting area as a angel / venture investor to invest in. But the problem is that there's so much hedge fund money out there that those trading guys go to the hedge fund and they say, oh, this is interesting, and, you know, whereas, like, a true seed investor would be like, okay, this is like an early stage company, they haven't built a product yet, let's do it at a $3 million per month valuation. The hedge fund guys have no clue, like, what these ranges are or anything else, and they'll just do it at a $50 million per month valuation because these guys are like, you know, they're used to numbers of billions at the end, 9 billions or something, and like, wow, that seems cheap, 50 million. What that does, though, and I've seen this many times, like, I've seen, like, then those guys go out, they build their software, and then they want to go raise more money.
And then they can't.
Yeah, then they can't, because they go to, like, professional tech investors, and they're like, 53, are you kidding me at this stage? Right? And meanwhile, they go back to the hedge fund guy, and the hedge fund guy's like, I don't want you to do a down round. Right? Because, I paid 50, this, I want the price to go up. You know, you're doing a bad job, do a better job. You know, and like, see this sort of failing happen. It's really just not the sort of battle around the thing. And so all these things kind of get screwed up by the excess kind of not smart money in New York. I think that's found, a lot of it's gone away now with the downturn, because the hedge fund guys are all, you know, either, you know, they've lost some money or they're going to jail, I guess, right at the time today or whatever else. But,
you're well inside of trading
there. Yeah. So, I don't know. Well,
how does that fit in with Hunch?
Yeah, so
and talk about Nextel a little bit about Hunch.
Yeah, absolutely. So, when we finished at McAfee, me and Tom Pinkney, who's my co-founder and site advisor, and two other guys who were sort of our key technical guys and site advisor, they're all Tom and those other, and Matt and Hugo, the two guys that are all MIT graduates who have a particular expertise in kind of artificial intelligence areas. We just literally the day after we were done at McAfee, we rented an office and this was in temporary space and said we want to build stuff. And
you know, being having an interest in consumer internet and having a technology kind of orientation, you know, we inevitably were sort of drawn to things around search, right? That's sort of where the action is, obviously, sort of tech-heavy consumer internet. You know, we're not the kind of guys that go building social networks, not our thing, or kind of techies. So we had this idea that would it be neat if
you have like a techie, like you're a techie guy that I'd see.
My technical partners are very technical, extremely techie. I used to program for years. I'm not a very good programmer, and so I'm sort of mediocre at a lot of things, including technology. So
terrible fit.
Yeah, but I think that, like, in other words, I just don't think that we have a competitive advantage. You know, like building a new social network, whatever. That's, you know, something like, you know, to give an example. I just think, you know, something that's sort of more technical. And so we had this particular idea, which was, wouldn't it be neat to build a system that kind of was modeled after how you interact with real human experts? In particular, like, imagine if I went to, you know, an example I often use is, like, I was trying to decide which college to go to, right? I'm a college high school student. And I go to a college guidance counselor and I say, I want to go to college, right? The good guidance counselor is not going to say, you should go to X college or Y college, right? They're going to ask you a series of questions. They're going to say, what do you want to study? You say this. And they say, what part of the country do I live in? You know, where world do I live in, right? And then they're going to say, well, you know, what's your grade point average? And then they're going to sort of ask you a series of questions. And presumably, like, a lot of those questions will be conditioned on how you answer the prior questions. And then finally, they'll sort of give you a set of recommendations. And those recommendations will be sort of based on your answers. In some cases, they'll have to make trade-offs because they can't find, let's say, a single university that satisfies all of your answers, but maybe they'll decide this is more right now or something like this. And we said, wouldn't that be a build system like that? Because that's how real human experts do it.
Yeah, and I've used Hunch a couple of times, and so it's asked me different questions and about iPhones and Twitter and stuff like that, and I've seen stuff you guys have put in your profile. I found that the answers I've gotten are generally accurate, really quite accurate, except that I found that sometimes the questions are leading, and I felt the questions are inaccurate.
I think that's an issue. I mean, one of the design changes I've made was that we only allow a certain, you know, you can only click on one of the existing answers, and sometimes people say, well, you know, I want to say maybe, not yes or no, for example. Is that kind of what you mean?
No, I kind of think questions like,
Like, do you like abortion? It says, do you like abortion?
It's a question like, there's really only one answer to, like, you know, is New York really a big city?
Yeah, well, so one thing you should know is that everything on Hunch is user generated.
Any question in, like, with questions on this survey aggregate.
We do have to say, like, for example, you can also, like, you know, this, it would be actually helpful if you next time you do that, if you can provide a question to things like that, and some users do that.
I feel like I'm getting minimal of that feedback because I haven't really used this either.
The best feedback is feedback people that are coming to it the first time.
Yeah, I've used it like three times.
Yeah, so, but, you know, a lot of people will, I think, so the answer is user generated, and, like, a lot of early, like, user generated sites that are in a pretty early stage. The content will vary. So there's some really good content and some bad content. And we hopefully have developed a system where the bad content gets better and gets surfaced. And so it's progressing and accruing knowledge. So about half of our what we call topics, which are like, you know, what college, half of them are things like what camera should I buy, which are sort of product related.
Right.
And on those, at the end of it, there are, if you like that, there's a link that's a sponsored link, very similar to Google, which if you click on it, you get some percentage.
So it's a list?
Yeah, exactly.
Are they generating revenue?
Yeah.
So it's actually like a lead gen sales process for affiliate marketing. So yeah. Kind of like pins, but more targeted pins almost.
Yeah, it's
and because you're doing it across every single type of question, so you're taking the best out of question sites like Yahoo Answers and all of those, and then you turn it into something that can become product related. So you'll build a brand through everything that's out there, like every kind of question, but then it'll tie it towards product questions, and then at the end you do have a revenue model. That makes sense.
Yeah, I actually think we have the best revenue model, which is Google revenue model. I mean, think about Google's doing the same thing, so you can type through anything. But if you actually look at it, more than half the time they won't still show any ads, right? Maybe we'll call for things, So they actually make the choice, unlike Yahoo and Zen, by the way. They make a choice where if it's a really low sort of effective CPM keyword, they'd rather not show an ad than show on a cluttered page.
I mean, I know a heck of a lot of guys would love to be able to buy all that inventory for Google yourself.
But Yahoo and Bing will do that, right? Yahoo, you play dead body, and they'll say, like, buy dead body on eBay, right? I mean, like, we're Google, like, at home. So Google made a choice, which is a really interesting and brave choice, which is to forego the revenue model.
But that's always how they come.
Yeah, that's great. It's a great thing about Google. But they, so 70% of the time, you know, like, you don't see ads on anything, right? So, like, in a way, what they're doing is they're using all that stuff as a way to sort of be a general purpose thing. They're making the money on, you know, when you say, like, I want to buy a camera or something, right? Very similarly on Hunch, like, a lot of the time we aren't, but then sometimes if you have purchasing intent, right, and that's a very valuable context. I think one thing about Hunch is we manage to do it in a way that's very natural and not doesn't feel like, you know, abusive at all. Like search, like, if you're asking, like, somebody's coming to you and saying, help me find a camera, it's very inoffensive to have things as a sponsored link. You'd be like, this camera, like, here, buy it, and if we have good, you know, good merchants, I think it's a good user experience.
Have you looked at what kind of conversion rates you're getting out of?
We have.
Because I imagine it's quite low right now, or is it?
I'm curious why you say that.
Because if I was investigating a camera, like, I have my camera here, and I was investigating cameras, I don't know if I'd make the final buying decision.
Well, that's exactly right. So the challenge is we actually have the because it's such a good purchasing intent context, we have good ECBM, or chemistry for say, it's not nearly as good as it should be, and it's precisely the reason you say it. We're sort of top of funnel, as they say, it's the top of funnel, right? The average camera buyer clicks on three affiliate links before they purchase it. The first two don't get paid, right? So the whole way, like, Amazon pays is last week is paid. Right. So, like, for example, the coupon sites are getting half of the revenue, right? Because that's where you tend to go at the very end of the process, right? People that help you find their merchant, shopping.com, et cetera, do very well. I would argue that this is a misallocation of people's affiliate revenue attribution or something, a misattribution of affiliate revenue, and that you talk to the really savvy like e-commerce sites, they will track all three of those clicks and try to allocate accordingly.
So, you know, what is a business model right there? So what you could do is, there should be a company that put together buyer's newsletters. So you could then, instead of the person just leaving the site, they could join a buyer's newsletter on Nikon D700 cameras that would send an email explaining more about it.
And get more information. Some of the stuff, like, what we're thinking about, like, yeah, probably not doing, right? Things that, yes, of course, later in the process. So, hey, I found a cool camera, flag it here, you know, remind me in the 2 weeks, or, you know, alternatively, you could add features, which is like, you know, hey, we help you find a camera when you're actually ready to buy it. We also have a good place, you know, compared to the shopping engine to buy one for. You know what I mean? Things that are later in the funnel as well. So, like, once you establish the early relationship and trust, you can help them, you sort of monetize them later in the process. Mm-hmm. But I also think that the world will change. I think that part of what we're betting on is that the e-commerce sites will get savvier and start correctly attributing first, second, third place, et cetera. Right? I mean, it's still going to happen on the last click they paid.
If it doesn't happen, though, what happens to business model?
We still get good people, because we still get enough people. Like, it's because it's like, the way they sort of like, so I use RPM, right? Revenue per thousand, I don't know if this is my favorite word for this, but revenue per thousand impressions, right? And I see it as, it's basically like,
isn't that CPM?
Well, ECPM or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, people say effective CPM, it's just, when we talk about revenue, you say effective cost per thousand, I don't know. So some people, whatever.
It's just, I mean, a metric that works across lots of media level.
Well, RPM is the same thing.
When you say RPM, does that mean CPM?
No, so it means it could be CPA, CPC, or CPM, but it's the effective revenue I'm getting for 1,000 impressions.
So does RPM mean effective ECPM?
Yes.
Okay, because that's the term that I'm used to, but if we're going to call RPM, that's cool.
Some people are now calling ECPM RPM. Okay. I just personally prefer it because I feel like it's a little bit okay. So obviously, it doesn't matter.
Let's go. I mean, you're awesome.
So we're still getting like $20 plus ECPM, so they're still good, but I think it could be $100 if we could really get, you know, the value that, you know what I'm saying? So, like, I still think we have a very, still, you know, kind of look at ECPMs in the consumer internet world, they're highly bifurcated. People that are socializing on a social network, it tends to be 50 cents to a dollar at that. People that are about to purchase a camera is, you know, much, much, much higher. And I think we're getting kind of in the middle range because we still have purchasing intent, but we're high early in the funnel. You know, I mean? So it's still good, but it's not, it could be better. And so I think part of that will be hopefully changing the way people do their media buying attribution, and partly we'll build features that kind of make us look at the funnel. But so, that makes sense.
Cool.
I actually have a series of blog posts on these topics. So I don't know if you haven't seen them. Actually, it was inspired by some great about blogging is that, the comments are often better than my posts, right. I think. And, like, I blog about how, you know, basically this point is made, which is that it's, you know, if you have purchasing intent, the ECPMs are vastly higher than if you don't. And somebody brought up some of the other points, like intent generation versus intent harvesting, and that was really interesting. And I actually then wrote a follow-up on that. And then I left another post, so the series of them are actually triggered by the very astute comments I got.
No, you could get some comments on the post.
Yeah, so. I love that discus thing. It's really disgusting.
Yeah. That's so nice. Yeah, I heard about the name. He's disgusting. Yeah. People see you called Disgusto. So he does. Yeah, we all do. I had Dustin drinking beer. So how does that, all of that feel with Punch? I mean, and, actually, I was talking with, I emailed with Katarina about, I guess, a question she made, which was that entrepreneurs should work themselves to death. And I'm interested in your comments on that, and then put some angel investing in your blog posting and what you're doing here, because it does seem like you're doing a lot of stuff at the same time.
I love doing this stuff. I mean, so, you know, like, for me, like, I don't know, like, for example, a lot of friends of mine watch sports. I don't really, like, for me, like, talking about startups is like sports. It's like, on the weekends, I'll go and talk to my friends, and we'll be like, see that startup, and like, oh, we need this, we should have this, you know, like, this is like fun, like, this is like a hobby, you know? Like, this is, you know, besides like spending time with family and friends, like, this is sort of what I like to do. Right? So, I don't really think of it as work. I mean, I probably work, you know, a lot of hours, I work pretty hard. And I think, Carrie's point, I think, was triggered by a conversation she and I were having, which was that, you know, in your first startup, I think you, this sort of mentality that you gotta, like, if I don't get up to 4 a.m. every morning pulling my hair out, I'm not doing a good job for the company. And I think over time you just realize how to kind of work smarter. And you kind of learn, you know, like, what you're good at and what you aren't and how to hire people that are better at doing those things. And, you know, and you just kind of, you get into it and sort of, like, you realize that freaking out all the time isn't gonna, sort of always being fire drill mode is actually quite counterproductive. And so, you know, there's, I think she works 60 hours a week or something. She's, so that's not like, you know.
But she's a mom to keep, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's still a bit of perspective. It's still like, you know, I think she's working hard, saying, like, don't work 120 hours, work, you know, whatever. And just sort of know what, you know, I think you just sort of know what you're good at and what you're not. And so, like, for example, this startup, I've hired people. For example, my last one, I was the product manager at SiteAdvisor. And here, I joined up with Katarina, who's a much better product manager than me. And I instead focus on the things I'm good at.
Which is?
That's a good question. What am I good at? What I'm good at is, well, I think, you know, I'm the sort of person who raises money for the company and will raise future money and kind of work on business model and then work on sort of technical side of the product. Like, this is a fairly technical product, and I sort of manage that side of it. I guess sort of the liaison between the engineering group. I mean, I fail this. We're 10-person company, so, you know, engineering group is four people later. I kind of know a little bit about everything, I guess, and kind of bridge the gaps between kind of the product and the engineering and the marketing, I guess. So, then I'm responsible for raising money, and I mean, I'm the CEO. I'm sort of the, we have venture investors. I'm there. I'm sort of the person they yell at if there's something to yell about, you know, that kind of thing. And recruiting is a big thing. Kind of recruiting and keeping people is a huge part of the startup.
And what does Karen do? Is that strength?
She's a phenomenal product designer. We can just look at Flickr and see, that was a collaboration. She was a big part of that. She really understands how to build kind of a community of people around products. She's done that launch. We have a very active community of people that are contributing content. I think really feel a strong sense of identification with each other and with Punch. And she's just a great speaker, and she goes out and talks to the press, and she's extremely articulate, thoughtful, and all sorts of other things. So I think sort of everything around the product and the marketing, and she's also on the board of, it's like, you know, me and her and the investors on the board, and helps. We used to talk about sort of strategy and what should we be spending our time on, what should we be spending, having our employees spend time on, what should we be, that kind of thing. She's great.
How did you guys meet and start to work together?
We met, Reed Hoffman, was an investor in Flickr and his friend Zuccaria. And he is buddies, he's on the board, he supports kind of LinkedIn. And one of our investors, Bessemer, is an investor in LinkedIn. And I'm friends with this guy, Jared Levine, who's a Bessemer partner. On board with Reed, because they know each other. And so Katarina was living in California, but comes to New York a lot because she's on the board of Etsy, and was actually originally looking to join another board only. And I met her in that context, and sort of like she might be another someone to sort of get involved in kind of a board level, which she's kind of like, you know, consulting a couple hours a month kind of level. But I think, she actually was at, the first course acquired by Yahoo, and at Yahoo, one of the products she worked on for a long time was Yahoo Answers, which has been one of the most successful, probably the most successful internally built Yahoo product this decade, and it's been very successful. But having worked on that, she recognized the shortcomings of it. In particular, the fact that sort of you someone asks a question, someone else comes along and answers it, and then it sort of dies off. You know, it's like, it's one of the problems, it's a very specific question. So like, going back to my college example, it'll be like, I'm a 16-year-old in physics who, like, you know, wants to live in North British College, like someone says, whatever, MIT, and that's it, right? And unless someone else comes along with the exact same situation, that piece of text is kind of irrelevant to you, right? And so that the system itself, while it serves a purpose, I'm a big fan of that website, it doesn't sort of accrue knowledge and get better the way Wikipedia. Wikipedia, like, truly gets better over time. Okay? Yeah, I just kind of keep solving these problems and then they kind of come back.
Well, Google allows it to, and I'm reading interesting posts talking about how you used to use Yahoo Finance and MapQuest and all these other mapping services, and now we just use Google everything.
Sure,
so at what point does Google just really roll out its own version of Wikipedia, and then what do you use that?
Well, they kind of try to know, right? It's hard though. You know, Wikipedia it's been 10 years in the making, and there's a lot of content on there and a lot of thought going into it. Google has shown a lot of phenomenal talent along the way, but not around sort of user generated stuff. So I think, going back to Carrie, I think she hadn't worked on that problem, saw that when she saw our product, it understood that we were trying to solve a problem which hadn't been solved and which she thought was important. And she wasn't intending to actually join us full time. But I think because the product was kind of sucked into it, and now it's full time. And so she's full time on this.
So your sales guy, you got on board.
I think the product sold itself. I really don't. I think
that's what every good sales guy says. Come on, Chris, give me a break.
I think all these things are kind of, a lot of these things are snowballed too. It's like you recruit good people, they sort of help recruit good people, and like, they make a team, and she saw that, and she also then sort of helps us get other good people, and so,
cool. And so how do you manage your time between all this stuff? Well, you're just saying you just do it all and just because you...
Well, I'm full-time. So I come into the office and I do fun full-time. Then I'll meet with people throughout the day sometimes who are just interesting people like you. And that is interesting to me both in respect of my job at Hunch and my investing. And it's a lot of being in the startup world is just meeting interesting people. So I just do a lot of that. Investing stuff doesn't take much time to meet with a company. I'm partnering with two people who are full-time on it, so an interesting company will come to me, I'll say, hey, I think it's interesting, I'll pass it off to them, they'll do sort of due diligence and work on it, the legal documents and all that. I don't need to do any of that, which is kind of the best of all worlds, so that can be the fun part. And when they're, like, looking to hire a new engineer, I might go an engineer because I'm spending a lot of time meeting people. So that's kind of more helpful, kind of as a connector or something, mostly, yeah. And then, like, I meet with VCs all the time. And partly that's because I'm going to some way raise another round financing for Hunch, but also, it's part of the crop I started, so I invested in partly just to chat, and, you know, there's all sorts of, like, this is a very small world, and everyone chats with each other all the time, and you're sort of, you know, there's nothing, you know, with the exception of a few blogs, like threads or something, there's very little of this world is written, this stuff that goes on in this world is written down. Huh. And so you need to sort of talk to people all the time if you want to stay up to date, huh, like, what's happening.
So you actually learn a lot more about what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, like what deals are, like, you know, I know all the deals happening in New York right now, and, like, what stage are in, what the valuations are, and it's important to me because you know, I have my own investments, and I want to, like, by knowing all the benchmarks and, like, what the hell is going on, you can kind of help your own investments think strategically, and, you know, here's what companies at your stage are, what valuations and terms they're seeing, et cetera. You know, like, and it's all the stuff you can only learn through chat, or, kind of, you know, there's no one's publishing. So even Fred is incredibly open about everything, but he is publishing. Does he have public valuations, or, you know, or, like, all the stuff that people, that they really kind of really see stuff? No, he doesn't, he can't, you know, it's like,
So Silicon Valley is quite a bit in front of New York in terms of just the community and what's going on. What do you think needs to happen out here in New York to catch up or be stronger? And New York is the, it's kind of like, for me, it's almost like the headquarter of capitalism in the world. I mean, this is it. Yeah. This is ground zero, but it's really not in the next place.
No, I think the first thing that had to happen did happen, which is the financial bubble collapsed. Because what that was a giant stock of talent on the East Coast. You know, like, I would go speak 5 years ago to a top computer science student at MIT, let's say, and try to recruit them. And they would just be like, I would be sane to go work at a startup when I can go, I mean, I literally have situations where you'd offer a guy, you know, whatever, $80,000 a year, and they can offer $500,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, in that kind of environment, I mean, like, it
doesn't really leave them with any choice.
It doesn't. Really, you know, their parents are like, even if they want to, their parents are like, what are you, fucking crazy? You know, like, I mean, like, yeah, like, it just doesn't, right? So, like, this is the environment, and that, what that leads to is, like, in the same way in Silicon Valley, everyone's, like, sort of, like, into getting equity and all the other things. Here, they're all talking about their hedge fund openness and all this. And so it just led to this environment where the only people we really recruit were kind of eccentrics who just didn't care about money. Right. Something like this.
Maybe some of those people, too.
Yeah, they are some great people. It's really, you know. But I think, at least, and by the way, inflation is probably going to be quite the other way, which is all these, like, ex-bankers and having startups, and that's probably a bad thing. But I think the good thing is there are really, you know, East Coast still is dominant in terms of, like, let's say, you know, great universities, as an example. Mm. And that's often the source of lots and lots of startup talents. And, you know, I think when it gets to the point where it's not, you know, like Facebook started at Harvard and moved west, and for the last 10 years has been perceived that you're crazy if you don't move west.
Right.
I think, you know, to the extent that we can kind of build enough of an ecosystem here, including this kind of stuff I'm trying to do with Fun, and Fred's doing, BayWorks is doing, and, you know, a lot of great startups are doing, you know, we have, like, Foursquare everyone's talking about, and a bunch of other things going on, and, you know, I think if we sort of have enough critical mass, it'll start to be that the next Mark Zuckerberg doesn't feel like he has to move to California, and that's, you know, kind of how we start to see, you know, I think the other big one for us is that New York setting center capitalism center of media and advertising.
Right.
Which, you know, more and more technology media and advertising are converging, right? In the 90s, the internet was a lot about sort of optical switching and infrastructure and all that kind of stuff. That stuff's kind of built. Mm. It's working. And now it's much more about sort of higher up layer of media and advertising. And you think naturally it would be play to New York's strengths, you know. And, you know, I think New York is like Silicon Valley in that it's very sort of immigrant friendly, it's very diverse, it's very, you know, people like to move here and start things. You know, I bet you that if there's some really big startups here, you know, some of them will be from people who just moved here, right? They won't be people who grew up in Manhattan, right? This is generally the case with New York, right? I mean, most people, I think there's, like, there's the people that grew up in Manhattan, there's the commuters, and there's the people that kind of come here because they live off the energy of it, and they love it, and they, you know, and they want to sort of make their mark here or something. And, you know, I don't see why. I think if those people now shift away from finance and shift away from the kind of traditional media and advertising world and think about this new one, and that inevitably involves technology, I think you probably will see, the types of companies you'll see here will probably be different than that, right? They'll be sort of more Huffington Post than Twitter or something, right? They'll be sort of have more of a media component. But I think all the pieces are in place for kind of a real boom here, I would think. But you know, that's a sense I have, and a sense, you know, I think other people have. But you never know.
It seems to me it should be a lot stronger. But maybe that's so. What you're saying? Maybe that's an app.
Yeah, I think it's on the right. That's where I'm betting. That's what I'm putting my money there.
So what's next for you? I mean, you're going to do Hunch?
I'd love to do Hunch, and, you know, and hopefully I'd like to build it at least as well. We'll see. You know, so, I'm sort of very happy doing this and investing inside. And, you know, I just think I really like the people I work with and the sort of lifestyle working at startups, and just continuing that.
Anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about?
I don't think so. I mean, unless you do anything else.
That's all I'm here. Thanks.
Yeah, great. Thank you.